If you enjoy listening to adventure stories, then you should visit thedihedral.com. You will find stories from other members of the community and read about climbing, life, and the outdoors. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Let's connect and climb on!
Climb on!
This is Kara, along with Gaia.
Hello!
And today we're joined on the Dihedral podcast by one of the great philosophers of our time, Emily Thomas. Dr. Thomas received her PhD from Christ College at Cambridge, and she's currently Associate Professor of Philosophy at Durham University and Honorary Fellow at the Australian Catholic University's Dionysia Institute of Philosophy. Dr. Thomas has dozens of journal publications and has written three books to date. The titles include Early Modern Women on Metaphysics, Absolute Time, Rifts in Early Modern British Metaphysics, and the recently released The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad. In addition to her robust scholarly contributions, Dr. Emily Thomas maintains an incredibly fun and informative Twitter voice, where she has been retracing the 1795 voyage of Mary Wollstonecraft through Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. I'm not sure I have the words to express how fortunate we are to have her on the show, so let me just start by saying thank you, Emily, for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we would like to focus on your most recent book, The Meaning of Travel, Philosophers Abroad, and we were hoping you could give our listeners a short description of what the book is about.
So the book looks at philosophical issues around travel, and it starts in the 16th century with Francis Bacon, who decided that if you wanted to learn about the world, you shouldn't just sit in an armchair, that the best way to do science was actually to get out into the world, observe it, and collect stuff from it. So he created this new philosophy of science that inspired generations of sailors and merchants to sail away to foreign shores away from Europe and bring back sort of plants and rocks and various bits of information about the places that they uncovered. So it starts with Bacon and then it moves forward through time, looking at the way people like Descartes, Locke, Margaret Cavendish, Henry Thoreau have engaged with travel from a philosophical perspective. It finishes with various contemporary issues, such as the ethics of traveling in an era of climate change. It asks what maps are, the way that maps have the power to affect our world, and it looks at issues around gender and travel.
So I've read quite a few books during quarantine, and this is by far my favorite. But on top of what Emily just described, I'd like to add just to the listener, there isn't a negative review that exists about this book. It has a perfect 5-star rating on Amazon. I wouldn't hesitate to recommend it to anyone, including all the dirtbaggers and backpackers who may be listening. This is absolutely a book that belongs on everybody's shelf, limited as that space may be if you're living in a van or hiking through the wilderness.
That's really kind. Thank you. You write these things in a room by yourself and you never know what people are going to make of them. So I'm really delighted to hear that.
Absolutely.
And it is a magnificent and very interesting, unique book. So I want to get, we'll get into the details of it in a little bit, but I want to know, and I was hoping that you could explain how the writing process was or the inspiration behind it. Do you ever have an aha moment? This is it? Or have you been working or working on this or playing with it throughout a couple of years?
The very idea of writing a book on philosophy and travel snuck up on me. So I've spent a lot of time backpacking. That's something I've been passionate about for years, since I was a teenager. And I've never thought previously about combining travel and philosophy until I reached a point in my professional life where I had finished writing one of the very serious books that you mentioned earlier, and I sort of had this lull. And to my surprise, always before I knew it was happening, I found that I was writing this much lighter book on philosophy and travel. And that happened really quite organically. What was harder was actually figuring out a structure for the book. I had all these places where philosophy and travel intersect, but figuring out how to make that into a story, that was a process that took time.
Now that's actually one of my favorite things about this book, just your ability to relate the reader who may not have a lot of experience in philosophy with these deeper philosophical issues. You do a great job of explaining these issues to anybody, the philosopher or maybe even a novice or somebody who hasn't even touched philosophy. And I think it made the book a lot more meaningful. And just kind of bouncing on that, I love the way you laid out the book. There's almost a journal quality to it that goes along with the depth of philosophy and this kind of new direction into the philosophy of travel. But anyway, I want to ask a particular question. Oftentimes, when one travels to an exotic or foreign land, they return a changed person. I just used air quotes for people listening. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the problem of personal identity and how that relates to this concept of being a changed person through travel.
So the idea that people change through travel has been around for a really, really long time. Since at least the ancient Greeks, people have worried that travelers go off and they return home so radically changed that they might even bring back dangerous ideas to society. What you get a bit later, especially as tourism begins to develop in the 17th, 18th centuries, is people traveling, leaving home deliberately to change themselves. They had this idea of personal growth, that seeing new lands or meeting new people will help them to mature and to become more learned, more cultured, that these things are really good for them. And in philosophy, we talk a lot about what makes someone the same person over time. So why am I the same person now that I was 5 days ago? And there are various different answers that have been proposed. You might think you're the same person because you have the same body, or maybe because you have the same mind, like the same memories, the same beliefs. Something that I personally think is true as a result of traveling is that the way our minds work is tangled with our environments. So there's this view in philosophy called the extended mind thesis, and it became really popular sort of over 10 years ago now. And the idea is that human minds are really tangled with the stuff around us, with the tools that we use all the time, with our mobiles, our laptops, calculators, pens and papers, that these are objects in the environment that help us think in a really literal way. And if they are helping us think, then they are part of our minds. And something that I think can explain the way that people change through travel is the fact you can leave your cognitive environment behind. I can go away and leave behind all my notebooks and my laptop and my phone. And then I think there's a sense in which changing the environment you find yourself in is literally going to change the composition of your mind. So this is a real like 21st century take on this old problem of why do you change when we travel?
You mentioned tourism and then also the fact that you can travel and leave your books and your phone behind. I guess it also depends on the type of traveling. If you're backpacking, I guess your mind's somewhere else, but you also see this Instagram personalities that travel and they document everything that they're doing. So it makes me think that tourism may not offer the level of change that some of the early explorers must have endured, for sure. But it certainly provides something novel to its participants. Is it possible for you to explain what tourism means and how it started?
I can. So I will say, I completely agree with you. It is possible to leave home, but take all of your stuff with you. And then it seems like maybe it's going to be harder to change if you still have your mobile in your pocket and you can still watch all your favorite TV shows. But it's definitely still possible to leave all that stuff behind. It is just a choice you know, you could leave and buy everything you use out in another country. But yeah, origins of tourism. So, which I quite like, I have to say. Yeah, traveling without any of the stuff from home is quite a nice thing to do. Origins of tourism. In the West, it really started in the 17th century with this phenomenon called the Grand Tour. And this is where wealthy young aristocrats, usually men, decided to leave their home countries to travel around Western Europe. And they perfect their languages, they visit historical sites, they do lots of shopping so that when they go home, they can adorn their houses with these beautiful paintings and statues that they've picked up in foreign countries to show how cultured they are. And the Grand Tour really was only available to a privileged few. But as time went on, travel became cheaper. And then by the late 18th century, things like mass tourism, it really became more common, with the upper middle classes also traveling abroad, still almost exclusively around Western Europe. And gradually, tourism has just opened up more and more until today, like many, many people can travel easily. Not everyone, but many.
I was so impressed with some of the names that you dropped for, I think they're called bears. Is that true? The leaders of the, I was just like, it was flooring. And I was wondering if that was something you knew. I mean, these just big time philosophical names, or people who are now known as big time philosophers leading these tours. I was wondering if that was something that you knew going into your research, or when you came across Barclay leading these tours, you're like, oh my goodness, how did that affect your thoughts on some of these great philosophers?
I was really surprised to learn about this. These young aristocrats, the grand tourists, they were normally led by an older man who would help them, you know, journey around and learn their languages. And these older mentors were known as bear leaders. The idea being that their young mentees were like dancing bears that they had to keep on a strict leash. And as you say, like big philosophers like George Berkeley, Thomas Hobbes, they acted as bear leaders. I had absolutely no idea when I started this. In fact, to be frank, I wasn't entirely sure that there had been much engagement between philosophy and travel before I started the research. And it was a real pleasure to discover, oh no, there's been lots and lots. It just isn't talked about very much.
Those are some of the great benefits of unique research, is finding these gold nuggets along the way. So I just want to mention, as a group that is the Dihedral that primarily focuses its content on mountains, you have a chapter on mountain travel, and it was clearly one of my favorites. I don't want to take any of the details of this chapter away from our listeners, but the transition from mountains into the concept of the sublime was perfect. Can you perhaps give an explanation of the concept of the sublime and how it could relate to mountains and perhaps mountain climbing?
I can. So, this notion of the sublime is something that was developed by 18th century Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. And he wrote this book on the sublime and the beautiful. And what Burke is trying to do is ask about our aesthetic, our artistic reactions to things in the world. And he says, if you look at something like a flower, you have an aesthetic reaction to it. You might think that the flower is beautiful. But when you look at something like a raging waterfall, you're impressed by it in an artistic way, but in a different kind of way. You don't necessarily find it beautiful. You're impressed by its power. And he names this feeling the sublime, and it's supposed to be a feeling of pleasurable terror. So this is the kind of thing that you get when you stand close but not too close to the edge of a cliff, or when you're watching a thunderstorm that's just above you but you're not actually in real danger of being hit by the lightning. And Burke thinks that all different kinds of things can evoke this feeling of the sublime. And one of the key things becomes mountains. So the idea is that there is something sublime about standing on a mountain and feeling the power that this enormous bit of geography that has, you know, through the weather, through the landscape, like it has the power to kill mountain climbers. But the hope is that you're not really in danger. You're just standing on the mountain feeling the power. So you're getting this hit of pleasurable terror, but without actually being unsafe. And this seems to have like definitely fed into mountain tourism. Once these ideas of the sublime and became known, you get all these painters wandering halfway up cliff sides to paint mountains in stormy weather. And I think this is definitely part of what we want when we visit mountains. We want to feel their power.
Yeah, it was, as I was reading that, it really hit home, because oftentimes you're in a position when you're climbing and you have the gear and you feel safe, but there's still something. And as I was reading what you wrote and what Burke had to say, it just hit the nail on the head. It was just the perfect description for what I think a lot of rock climbers and mountain climbers aim for and approach. There's something about the sublime that feels good. But also, I think it was either in this chapter or your chapter about female travel, the commentary about how, no, this is not for females. You know, you see, you know, certain philosophers that we look up to and we praise, like Kant, like just stating some horrifying things about the role of gender roles along the way. And so as I was reading this, at first I was like, oh, this is great. And then all of a sudden I was like, no, this is really tragic that some of these writers didn't apply it to everybody.
This is not great anymore.
Exactly.
I think that's true. I mean, yeah, so there's this old traditional view that the role of men is to go out into the world and have adventures and travel around and explore, and the role of women is just to stay at home, to keep the hearth fires burning. And this is really deeply ingrained in views about travel. And what you then find with stuff on the sublime is Kant, who was a terrible, terrible sexist and racist, Kant says things like, well, men can be sublime, because of course men can be powerful and evoke pleasurable terror in people, and that women should never be sublime. They should merely be beautiful.
Horrifying.
It is horrifying. Agreed.
The other day we were just hanging out, and Carrot randomly approaches me and says, I have thought, what do you think would be harder, for us to go to the past and accommodate to how they used to live, or for someone from the past to come here and get used to the way that we live? And I started thinking for a moment. I said, maybe for us to go to the past because they didn't have the same commodities that we do. But then he said, well, but ideologically, the way that they see the world for them would be harder to understand. So now I wonder how Kant, for example, would arrive to the crack. That's how we call the area where people are climbing and seeing powerful, strong women just obliterating the mountain. I really think, well, how do you think he would react, or what would he say now that you've been able to read a lot about him and everything pertaining this topic?
I imagine he would be appalled, actually. But I hope it would be really good for him. eye-opening, and that it would change his views on some of these things. Really, his views need changing.
You're right. They need to learn. Well, they're already long gone, but we know. Mm-hmm. So this book is loaded with so many great quotes. There are ideas from past travelers and philosophers, but one writer who really seems to resonate today with the modern solo traveler is Thoreau. And you talk about something called cabin porn. So what exactly is cabin porn?
So cabin porn is a principally online phenomena that is not as bad as it sounds. It's primarily a form of photography where people photograph beautiful, isolated, rustic cabins. I picture like a cabin built out of logs with smoke spiraling out of the chimney. Maybe it's like perched on the edge of a lake, or else it's looking out over glaciers. And cabin porn is looking at all these photographs with a real desire to be there, to live in them. And there's even a book now titled Cabin Porn, and it's really, it's compelling. I look at these places and I really want to visit them.
We read your book in a reading group throughout quarantine, you know, this summer, and everybody in there was connected to philosophy in one way or another. And so when we started talking about the chapter, somebody wrote, who went to the website cabin porn, and every one of us were like, oh yeah, I went, there's some beautiful cabins built out of, it was a cool thing to do. But yeah, just one of the, I guess, eye-opening features of the book that as we were reading through the summer, that really engaged us in conversation was this idea of doom tourism. So I'm wondering if you could just in a moment describe what doom tourism is, and then go a little deeper if it's possible, to talk about whether or not you foresee a way to eliminate the doom while keeping the tourism in certain places like the Maldives or the coral reefs or the Arctic glaciers.
Yeah, so doom tourism is the idea of going to visit places that are seen to be doomed in some way. And the idea itself has been around for a really long time. People went to visit the Berlin Wall before it was about to be pulled down. Even older, we have stories of people going to visit shipwrecks before they sank. So this idea of seeing something before it's gone is an old one. What is new is, in the wake of increasing awareness about climate change, especially over the last 10, 20 years, is that suddenly there's this urge to go and see places that are doomed due to climate change. And this leads to big problems, because places like the Maldives or glaciers or coral reefs, all of these places are really fragile, and visiting them, it can itself hasten their doom, if you like. So one of the reasons doom tourism with regards to climate change seems so problematic is that we are really hurting the places that we desperately want to go and see. And that seems quite different from wanting to go visit the Berlin Wall before people are pulling it down. It feels like it's a real problem. And in terms of fixing this problem, I mean, the big solution would be, let's do something about climate change. And obviously there are increasing movements, you know, the Greta movement has been amazing at raising awareness of this stuff. Honestly, I also share her doubts that governments are going to do enough about this. I would really like to see more willingness politically. I feel like these are big problems and they have to be tackled on a big scale. But there are smaller things that we can do as independent travellers to keep the tourism and try and reduce the doom aspect. So there are schemes like the climate carbon footprint off setting, whereby, you know, you take a flight and then you use a clever program to make a donation to plant trees, for example, to offset the carbon that you've burned. I suspect that what's going to be even more helpful is traveling in a really mindful way, trying to be really aware of the places that we're going to see and researching the best ways to see them safely. And it might be that that involves reduced visitor numbers. You know, maybe a glacier can only sustain a limited number of tourists each year. And that's something that we're going to have to get in line and queue for it virtually. Or maybe it's going to mean visiting just one place on our summer holidays rather than taking sort of flights to kind of hop between lots of different places. But traveling mindfully and responsibly, I think is the best thing that individual travelers can do.
Yeah, I really love and appreciate you saying mindfully, and this is something you've talked about. You've offered a lot of really interesting points in the book about how to protect places. And one of those things is being mindful, just in a sense, even becoming educated about what a place is that might allow a visitor to respect a place so that they will at least carry their trash out with them or things like that. There's things that education can do that go beyond just learning a particular thing. And, you know, it gets very frustrating for us. We've talked to quite a few people who are really kind of at the front line of global warming, and it's hard, like you said, like bringing in politicians. And so there's little things that we can do. And I think that an education or some level of understanding about the place you're visiting helps you feel a type of compassion towards it that you want to protect it. I don't know. It was great. It was a wonderful chapter. So thank you. Thank you for writing it. It was really, really good.
I will also say, I think that educating ourselves about places, it can be good for this too. So in the chapter, I talk about this theory in the philosophy of art, that if you understand the background to an artwork, you're actually better placed to appreciate it. And I think that that's going to be true of places like the Maldives or glaciers. The more you understand about them, the greater your appreciation can be. And that's like a good selfish reason to educate yourself about these places. Two birds with one stone.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, it's the fact that you have to have mindful travelers, and now the fact of educating, when you know more about a place, you tend to respect it and appreciate it more. But it's sometimes frustrating because you start to think and you say, okay, we're so many people in the world. Let's think how many people actually want to put or invest time into doing that or would actually care. We have this issue that people don't see beyond where they're standing. So they look around, they say, oh, everything looks fine here, nothing's melting here. Probably it's not happening. If it's not happening to me, it's actually, or it doesn't have to be necessarily real. So when you encounter things like that, it's when you think, oh my goodness, is this still hope? Or I wonder how things will look in a couple of years. I had the opportunity to travel to Argentina when I was, I think, 14 years old or so. So it was it was 12 years ago, and we went to see Perito Moreno, which is this big glacier that they have there. And it was sad because even the Argentinian people that work and do the tourism there would tell you, appreciate it now because we are aware that in a couple of years it will not be here or it will be reduced in its size. So it's kind of...
That's really heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking, especially when people that live that and experience it and it's part of their life say, we are aware that it's not gonna be here. And then you have other people somewhere else in the world saying, oh no, climate change is not real or it won't affect us in any way and things like this. So we'll see what's gonna happen, but at least as long as some people are willing to do it, at least
the numbers will be. I mean, climate change is real and there will be
correct.
The evidence for that will only increase as the years go on. I will say, actually, that the coronavirus lockdown, a silver lining of that has been we have massively reduced, you know, flying and carbon emissions and things that I think previously people might have said would be impossible, like conducting lots of short business meetings online as opposed to, you know, taking one flight to go out and come back again. All of these things have actually proved possible. And I hope this will also feed into an attitude shift as to what's possible when it comes to, yeah, to tackling climate change. If we lived in a world where people traveled for tourism, unless for perhaps unnecessary business trips, that seems like a good thing.
Good place, good point to start, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. It would be something.
Okay, so we're getting a little bit depressed. The conversation's getting depressing. Actually, we got the opportunity to interview a scientist called Andrew Dessler, and he's an expert on all of this thing, climate change, etc. And I remember towards the end, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna open a bottle of wine. And he's like, don't get, my intention is not to make you depressed. This is the world we live in, get used to it. And I was like, oh my God. Okay. But moving forward.
Did he have ways of hope? about climate change.
He gave this really interesting analogy that I thought was pretty useful. And he's given it in interviews before, but he describes it, he's like, imagine you're about to get into a car accident and there's a car in front of you that's completely stopped. And so if we slam on the brakes right now, we're still going to hit them, but the damage will be mitigated. At the rate we're going, it doesn't seem like we're hitting the brake. And so in that sense, it's now up to us how hard we're going to hit the brake to try to reduce the damage that's going to be done. We can't eliminate it. And so in that sense, he's like, there's optimism. We need to stop living in the way that we are. But his big idea, and I thought this was really impressive. He says, look, all the things that we could do, you know, buying more earth-friendly cars or trying to limit our use of materials and carbon and things like this, that's not going to eliminate what's already done and what's going to be done. But those are still good things to do. What we really need to do is elect officials who will put caps on how much carbon can be released. Those are the big things that will cause change. So there's little stuff that we can do, but we also need to be active in helping the right politicians who care about these things become elected officials. So I don't know if I would call that optimism, but it's at least an optimistic option.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that. Awesome.
There are many entertaining aspects of the book, from your personal travel experiences to the depth of research and all the way to the artwork throughout the book, which actually the cover's beautiful. People, you have to go look at it because it's amazing, and then buy it and then read it. But okay, we don't want to give away much of the details. You'll have to read it for yourselves. So let's shift gears and wrap things up with something kind of lighthearted and fun.
So one of our friends, her name's Monica, she mentioned while reading your book that Thoreau sounds like he'd be an influencer in today's world. And this really got us to thinking, and having you as a guest, so you can maybe help us answer these. One, would he be an influencer? And then two, we have a list of who else might be influencers. So we have a group of authors that you mentioned in The Meaning of Travel, and we were hoping to get your expert opinion on whether or not they would be throwing out hashtags on Instagram in 2020 or 2021. So obviously we'll start with Henry David Thoreau. What do you think?
Yes, definitely. I really see that, actually. The only thing, so Thoreau was obviously the philosopher who went and built himself this cabin in the woods by Walden Pond. Thoreau places such an emphasis on being solitary in nature that what I almost see Thoreau doing is building this cabin without accessing the internet or his mobile phone. And then when he leaves after this period of 18 months, that's when he would be hitting Instagram, releasing his daily photos. He would always be a kind of like a reporter doing these like deep dives and then coming out and spreading the word.
It's so entertaining to just get that visual. It just I love it.
Imagine him vlogging.
Yeah.
This is what I did day number one. Buzz Lightyear that he does. Okay. In Spanish he says bitácora de Buzz Lightyear. I don't know how you say it in English, but he starts recording, but with like vlogging. Okay, Mary Wollstonecraft.
Definitely an influencer, I think, for sure. Like, Wollstonecraft wrote on every subject going. and she was writing it regularly in magazines, so not just writing books. And she was really, really conscious of the need to build a career for herself as a writer and doing things that would raise her profile and raise the profile of issues that she cared about, things like feminism and politics. And I absolutely think she would have used any tool at her disposal. In fact, yeah, I really do.
So what do you think about George Barclay?
Actually, Barclay, I don't see it so much. I feel like Barclay is a bit stuffier. He's obviously a priest and he's doing all of these philosophical and theological writings. Oh yeah, no, him I see it with less. I feel like Barclay is less interested in advancing causes than Thoreau and Wollstonecraft are. Yeah, and then it would be less of a thing for him.
Makes sense.
Albert Camus.
You know, I think if Camus was like on Instagram or Twitter, he would just be posting obscure, oblique things that everybody else would be struggling to make sense out of. Like really beautiful, but also impenetrable pieces. It's what I picture from Camus.
So one of my favorite people that you talk about in the book is Cavendish. Do you think she would be an influencer?
Yes, definitely, definitely, for sure. So Margaret Cavendish, so she's publishing fiction and plays and philosophy in the 17th century. And at that time, women were writing on these topics, but they were almost never publishing on them. It just was not done. And so what tended to happen with women is that they're exchanging like intellectual letters, and then maybe the letters are published after their death, or perhaps some male philosopher publishes an exchange, and then the female philosopher has to pretend that they never wanted the letters to be published, even though, you know, it seems like they probably kind of did. And that Cavendish just went for it. She's publishing books under her own name. And Cavendish also, if the biographies are right, enjoyed being famous. So there's an air of celebrity around Cavendish. There's this description where someone goes to see her, Samuel Pepys in London, and he describes how she gets out of a carriage and her dress is really fantastic and eccentric, and she's dressed all of her footmen in similarly like eccentric clothes. I mean, I wonder whether Cavendish would be someone who isn't posting to Instagram herself, but who is very much courting all of the people who would be snapping photographs of her.
And our last one, Emily Thomas.
Interesting question. I see myself as a writer much more than an influencer. I feel like you need more of a, like the best influences are really larger than life. And I suspect that I'm happier behind a desk than I am being out there in the world like Margaret Cavendish. But hey, if my writing about stuff like the importance of climate change can make a difference, fantastic. Right, like, let's get people thinking about these issues. They lie close to my heart.
That's perfect. I guess just for selfish reasons, if I can just throw in one more question. Gaia often frets when I go off script, but There's so
many. I'm enjoying the look on your face right now.
There's so many great books that you recommend throughout this book that we've been covering today, and I was wondering if maybe you could throw out a couple recommendations to our listeners that you would say, look, if you're interested in travel in any way, maybe these are a couple of books that you should have in your backpack.
That's a lovely idea. Yeah, okay. So I can offer a few recommendations. If you're really into the history of travel and you don't mind a slightly more serious take, I would read Paul Fussell's book Abroad, which is a kind of, it is a very readable history of travel between the wars, and he really gets into the motivations for why people are traveling and why they're going to the places that they are. If you're after something lighter, then Alain de Botton's The Art of Travel, which is an exploration of what artists and novelists have had to say about travel, is also, it's really beautifully written, and it's an extremely easy read in a way that Fussell is not. As a final wild card, I've really enjoyed this. It's pretty obscure, and I think you'd have to get a secondhand copy. But there's a book called Travelers and Travel Liars. I think it's written by someone named Percy. And the whole book is about people who have made up their travels. So they have simply sat at home and invented everything. But they've persuaded enormous reams of people. They really did the traveling that they claimed to have done. And there's been some articles over the last few years about, like travel writers or reviewers who are supposed to have covered like lots of different cities in just a week or, and then of course it comes out they haven't done any of these things, they've made it all up. Yeah. So I think in a sense this tradition continues today, but it's very funny.
That's yeah, I'll definitely I'll be searching for it for sure. Thanks, Emily.
I know some people like that though. I had a friend from school who was like that. She would tell you, I went and did this and that. So whenever we would travel, she's like, I'm going to be there. Let's meet up. And then she never replied. I was like, ah. Mm-hmm. She's like, she's gone to Germany, England, I don't know, Argentina, so many different places in the world. She has all of these stories, but I'm pretty sure she just made them up. Not real. Okay, so to wrap up, we always give our guests the opportunity to promote something or highlight something and say, okay, we call it plug something in. So if there's anything you'd like to share, any project or your book or anything else, then you're more than welcome to do so.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. I guess the only thing I would mention right now is that I am continuing with this Twitter project of tracing Wollstonecraft's journey. And the journey ends in September 1795. God, Emily, I have to get my... So the project won't be continuing for that much longer. But there's like another month and a bit or so left. I've really enjoyed it, actually. I've got so into her travel book. She's wandering through Norway, Sweden, Denmark. It's really beautifully written and lots of these philosophical reflections. Right, so if you want to join me on Twitter for that, that might be fun.
It is a lot of fun. I've been following along and it's just wildly interesting. So I agree. If you're looking for a second person to endorse this, yes, get on Twitter.
Well, thank you so much, Emily. I don't know if you'd like to add something, Carrot, or...
No, I just want to share that. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure. Maybe we can sit down with you and talk about one of your other books or future books sometime. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah, there will definitely be future lighter books.